Thank you, Reese acknowledged, taking a quick scan of its contents. Sir, ma'am, both patients were moved from Kindred Hospital to separate tents this morning. I do have some unfortunate news. Izzad Turan is dead. Chapter 47. Reese and Haley entered a small tent connected to a larger chemical biological protective shelter through a self-sealing door, part of an Army procurement program based on the requirement to treat U.S. troops infected after a chemical or biological attack overseas. The Smiths Detection CBPS Model 8E1 was designated the M8A4. Adapting to emerging threats, the program was later effectively diverted to National Guard units for use in the event of a chem bioweapon attack on the homeland. Attached to a tan, six-wheeled behemoth with a red cross painted on the side to identify it as a medical vehicle entitled to protections under the Geneva Conventions, the mobile, self-contained protection system was designed to provide a contamination-free working environment. The black laminated sign on its side did not go unnoticed by either of them. Inside the first tent was a large clear plastic and stainless steel box with dual airtight locking doors. "Let's hope this works," Haley said through her mask. "What is it?" Reese asked. "It's a mobile level 4 biocontainment module." "That sounds serious." "These CBRN hazmat suits don't provide the requisite level of protection for what we will be dealing with in there."
"They're good enough for the military guys, but not for us?" Reese asked.
"Typical. If this was a respiratory spread pathogen, which it's not, and as long as they are not directly interacting with infected patients, those mil-spec hazmat suits would work and do what they are designed for, namely protecting soldiers from anthrax, mustard gas, and sarin. They are not designed to provide protection from a level 4 pathogen, and there simply aren't enough self-contained level 4 suits to outfit everyone in the military. That's why the military is on the outside and not interacting with anyone inside the containment area. You ready to get naked?"
"Naked?
Just follow my lead. This first module is positively pressurized. We'll change out of this CBRN equipment and into fully self-supportive biocontainment suits with their own oxygen supply before moving into the CBPS.
The what?
The Chemical Biological Protective Shelter. It's negatively pressurized.
Why is that? Reese asks.
In this case, it's to keep the virus inside. Just do what I do if you want to live.
When they emerged, Reese thought they resembled astronauts. Each of them wore a small canister of oxygen on their back to pressurize the suit and allow them to breathe. Large, clear plastic face shields were incorporated into the PPE, and they were fitted with microphones for external communication. They passed under UV lights and pushed aside the heavy plastic flaps and fitted door to enter the negatively pressurized CBPS. In contrast to the desert tan exterior, the inside was stark white. It was constructed to eliminate the need for protective clothing. In contrast to the original intent, it was now being used to contain the virus itself. So anyone entering the space was required to be in full level 4 PPE. The 400 square feet of usable treatment space held only one patient. Cots lined the interior, cots that Reese knew would soon hold more expectant bodies after Sharam Pahlavi was zipped into a body bag and moved to a refrigerated semi-truck. A guard in a level 4 suit stood watch and exited when the pair entered, as he had been instructed. "Stay behind me," Reese ordered, more out of habit than out of any concern that their target would attempt to attack them or escape. Pahlavi was on a wheeled gurney behind another plastic covering that reminded Reese of cheap shower curtains. Reese stood outside with Dr. Garrett and took stock of the patient. An intravenous morphine drip was connected to a vein on his hand, and an electronic vital sign monitor beeped away atop a portable stand. It was evident that Sharam Pahlavi was going to die. Blood had dripped from his nose and over his mouth, mixing with the yellow vomit that had accumulated on his chin and chest. His eyes were closed, but his body shook as it used what little reserves of energy it had left to fight the fever that ravaged his body and brain. He had been covered with a blanket. As Reese and Haley watched through the opaque plastic, it slipped to the floor, exposing arms and hands purple with internal hemorrhaging. He was sweating blood. Reese was not a trained interrogator. In fact, on his list of skills, interrogation was ranked at the bottom. He'd attended an interrogation school in the SEAL teams, and his takeaway had been that he should leave tactical questioning to the professionals. It wasn't until his assignment to a CIA covert action program that he had been introduced to the darker arts of what they called enhanced interrogation, lessons he'd applied after his family had been violently taken from him. Reese shook off the memory. Those lessons in interrogation and torture were not going to work on a man about to touch the face of God. Even with Dr. Garrett's assurances, Reese was hesitant to engage. What if she's wrong? Too late. This guy is somehow connected to the virus and to the attack on Katie. Do it. Reese nodded at Haley and then entered the domain of the virus. Reese kicked the gurney.
Sharam.
He kicked it again. Sharam, he said louder to overcome the slight muffle of the microphone built into his suit. Sharam's eyes fluttered open and Reese fought back the urge to recoil. The eyes had sunk into their sockets, the skin around them purple with broken capillaries, his entire body hemorrhaging from within as the virus liquefied organs in its quest to find a new host. The pathogen had its own mission, to live. Sharam closed his eyes again, his breathing shallow.
My name is Sebastian,
he whispered.
Your name is Sharam Pahlavi. Your parents are from Iran. You are a terrorist and you are about to die,
Reese said without the slightest hint of sympathy.
Shahada,
the figure said, appearing more like a zombie than a man.
There is no God but Allah. I want you to listen to me closely, Sharam,
Reese continued.
You do not have much time. That means you are going to have to think clearly.
Reese stepped toward the machine monitoring vitals and controlling the morphine and sedative on a timed release with intravenous fluids. He turned both machines off.
Cremation is forbidden in Islam, Sharam. You know that. Those who are cremated go to hell. That's what I am going to ensure happens, not just to you, but to your mother and father after I kill them. Take solace in the fact that you will see them again soon. Not in paradise, but in the fires of Jahannam.
Reese could sense Haley staring at him through her gas mask. He took a knee, bringing his face closer to that of his subject.
Your body will not be washed in accordance with your faith, nor will it go to a mosque for Salat al-Janazah. It's going to be packed in a refrigerated box truck, along with hundreds of dead infidels, infidels that you helped kill. You will be stacked between other bodies for days, maybe months, until you are incinerated.
With startling speed, Sharam spit a bloody chunk of bile into his interrogator's face. The frothy red liquid hit Reese's face shield, slowly sliding down onto his suit. Reese resisted the urge to pull back, aware he could not afford to give his target a psychological edge.
Trust the suit, Reese.
Reese slowly rose to his feet. He opened a manila folder and held up a photo. It was a beige home built against a red rock hill with a cactus dominating a small rock garden.
Your parents' home in Scottsdale, Reese said, dropping it onto the dying man's chest.
He pulled out another photo of a woman pushing a shopping cart in a strip mall outside a Whole Foods.
Your mother.
He dropped it onto Sharam's chest, where it stuck to the sticky vomit. He extracted another of a man getting out of his car in the driveway of the house with the cactus.
Your father, Reese continued. Both will be dead in hours if you do not give me what I want. And I'll make sure to stack their bodies with non-believers. Better yet,
I'll stack them with the Jewish bodies and then burn them together to ensure they spend eternity with you in hell.
Reese,
Haley said. Even through the mask, he could see the horror in her eyes.
Ilah,
Shahram recited. There is no God but Allah. Enjoy your final prayers, asshole. Remember, it won't be me killing your parents, it's you. Reese turned to leave, passing a stunned Dr. Garrett.
Wait.
Reese turned. What was that? He said.
I don't know all of it. Just, please, promise me you will bury me in accordance with Sharia and not harm my mother and father.
That is all up to you, Shahram. Your position in the afterlife and what happens to your parents all depends on what you tell me right now before you leave this world. You can't save yourself in this life, but you can save your mother and father.
They wanted me to build a lab.
A lab? Reese asked. Shahram closed his eyes. Who, Shahram? Your family is depending on you, Reese said, holding up the photo of his mother now stained with blood and vomit.
I don't know. I was just told to build a lab.
A lab? Haley asked, stepping forward. What type of lab?
Virology. That's my specialty.
What kind of equipment? She asked, taking control of the interview.
Electron microscope. Centrifuge culture cabinet. Heat vents. UV exhaust vents.
What for? Haley asked.
For the kidney cells.
Help us help you, Shahram, she said. What kidney cells?
Green monkey. From Africa.
Shahram, this is important. Did you separate them into independent cell lines? And did you introduce a sample? They had clearly surpassed Reese's infectious disease knowledge. He was now a spectator, as Haley dove into the specifics. Shahram coughed, more blood trickling from his mouth and nose. Reese noticed blood beginning to drip from his ears as Haley pressed on.
Shahram, we need to know,
she said, her voice calm and compassionate.
Think of your parents, Shahram, Reese interjected.
Haley turned and gave him a stare that told him to back off. Shahram closed his eyes again.
Ashhadu an la ilaha illallahu. Ashhadu anna Muhammadan Rasulullahi.
I bear witness that there is no deity but God, and I bear witness that Muhammad is the messenger of God.
Reese was getting impatient. The constraints of the suit and the claustrophobia of the mask were pushing him closer to the edge. The man before him was responsible for a virus that threatened to ignite a new civil war, and more important to Reese, he was somehow connected to the assassins who had targeted him and Katie in Maryland. Stuck upside down in the overturned Land Cruiser, drawing his pistol, eye picking up the red dot, knees exploding from the impact of the bullets, headshot.
Fucking talk, Shahram! Fucking talk, or I swear to God I will fillet your mom in front of your father before dismembering them both and burning their worthless bodies. Their souls will never find peace. They will haunt you in the afterlife.
I...
Fucking talk!
Haley stared at Reese in disgust, then turned back to the patient.
Just take a breath, Shahram. Think and tell me the nature of the sample that was introduced.
Shahram's bloody eyes drifted from Haley to Reese. His vision blurred from fever and a virus that was liquefying his brain. But through the haze, he studied Reese, seeing not a man but Azrael, the angel of death.
Mar...
His voice trailed off, more blood dripping from his nose.
What?
Haley asked, trying to encourage him.
Marburg.
Haley felt the blood draining from her face.
What type of Marburg?
Variant U.
Dear God in heaven, where did you get it?
Gasping for breath, his body shuddered, and he retched a greenish-yellow vomit mixed with tinges of dark blood onto his pillow and chest.
Where did you get it? Rhys shouted, reinserting himself into the interrogation. Was it this man?
Rhys shoved a blurry photo in front of Sharam, a photo he'd taken in Chicago of a figure leaving the house of his first target. Before Sharam could avert his eyes, Rhys saw the recognition.
In the lab, Sharam, is it in the house you bought in Denver?
Sharam remained silent.
Sharam,
Haley said, needing more information.
How does it spread? Did you aerosolize it?
He gave a slight nod.
Can it be passed from human to human?
He paused.
Your parents, Sharam, Rhys barked.
I don't know where it came from. How is it spread? Direct bodily fluid contact. Contaminated blood. Is it a respiratory disease? I can't be certain. It was released in aerosolized form. I don't know why.
To cause this,
Rhys said, gesturing to the cots awaiting bodies against the green canvas walls of the tent.
I don't know.
Who knows? This man?
Rhys asked, pointing to the surveillance photo he'd taken in the Windy City.
I don't know. Please.
His voice was getting weaker.
You are a shitty liar, Sharam. Tell me about him. Who is he?
Praise be to Allah. I do not know.
He lied to you, Sharam. Did he tell you that you were part of the team? That you were a warrior of Allah? Is this how a warrior of Allah dies? He killed you, Sharam. He killed you to tie up loose ends. You were always a liability, an expendable asset. This is a man you want to protect?
No,
Sharam murmured without conviction.
Where can I find him? How did you contact him?
I didn't. He came through the mosque. Please.
What mosque?
Please.
The FBI is raiding your house now. We are going to find everything, Sharam.
This is all I know. Alhamdulillah.
Praise be to God. His breath was coming in shorter gasps, eyes rolling back into their blood-filled sockets, red drops of what should have been tears trickling down his face.
Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi,
he whispered. Verily we belong to Allah, and verily to Him do we return. Rhys bowed his head and whispered the istirja before flipping the morphine and vital sign monitor back on and signaling to Haley that it was time to go. They pushed their way through the clear plastic curtains and walked toward the exit, leaving Sharam Pahlavi to die a martyr, wondering if Azrael, the angel of death, would keep his promise. Chapter 48. West Colfax, Denver, Colorado. The key was to make it look just enough like an accident to raise questions. He'd used fire once before on a houseboat in Amsterdam. That had been easier. He had started it in the engine compartment of a small boat moored alongside. This was different. If authorities suspected that the virus was not naturally occurring with an index case in Angola, then a suspicious fire in a house on the outskirts of Aurora belonging to one of the first casualties might prompt some enterprising American detective or intelligence operative to start asking questions. That, or at least it would add fuel to online conspiracy theorists who would muddy the waters enough to cause even the staunchest government supporters to question the official narrative. It would be Angola or homegrown terrorism. Even though the perpetrator was of Middle Eastern descent, he was a U.S. citizen. No nukes would rocket toward Tehran, no U.S. boots would set foot on Persian soil. An America in ruins. A reshuffling of the world order. Ali had already found anti-government conspiracy websites theorizing that the virus was concocted in a U.S. lab, as many believed had been the case with COVID-19 in Wuhan, China, Twitter was ablaze with conjecture from shock jocks and conspiracy theorists speculating that the virus was intentionally released as justification for a federal power grab. Gun confiscation was surely next, followed inevitably by re-education facilities and, for the real troublemakers, concentration and death camps. The Bill of Rights was bound for the dustbin of history. Ali loved the power of a free press. Its power was amplified when everyone had a voice. Theories without a foundation in facts or basis in reality could take flight and go viral. No barriers to entry, no editors, no fact-checking, or if there was, it couldn't be trusted. Fact-checkers had biases and agendas too, after all. The loudest voices dominated the chaos that was social media hysteria, and all of it contributed to the chaos. Suppression and censorship only fueled the flames. If the Angola angle began to look dubious, Ali was setting the conditions for another equally compelling narrative. A U.S. citizen had conducted the plan, using university assets to build a virology lab and unleash a devil upon the populace. Whichever way one leaned, the end result remained the same. The United States would continue to turn against itself, and by the time they found out the virus was not actually a respiratory spread contagion, it would be too late. Two American cities would be destroyed, and the country would never recover. Pity that Chicago would be spared, but that could not be helped now. Even the Atlanta numbers didn't support the destruction of that city, but the few cases that had surfaced reinforced the perception that this new Ebola strain spread through the air. Iran would have her revenge, and no one would be the wiser. Ali would avenge the deaths of his father and two brothers, killed by an American war machine that profited from Defa'e Mogadas, the Holy Defense, the Iran-Iraq War. Yes, Islam would be blamed if they connected Sebastian to the plot, but everyone who unleashed the virus would be gone. Investigators would hit a dead end. Two American cities would be smoldering embers without Iran ever firing a shot. The very pinnacle of warfare. He'd tasked Sebastian with destroying the lab, better to keep his own involvement to a minimum. Ali had stayed behind to ensure it was done. He had not expected the virus to take hold of the young PhD student so quickly. No matter. Adapting to a changing environment was paramount. It was also why the warriors of Allah had an advantage over the entrenched bureaucracy of their enemy. The house was so old, even the floorboards had rotted through in places. It was a prime candidate for an inferno. With so many assets allocated to investigating the fires and destruction connected to the riots and looting in downtown Denver, this incident could easily be explained away as having been started by someone building firebombs to target police. Molotov cocktails and fireworks had become popular with American insurgents in the summer of 2020. Ali even had an Antifa flag to leave behind for an arson investigator to discover in the rubble. The point was to muddy the waters with further conjecture and confusion. He just needed to dismantle the computer in case Sebastian had been careless and left electronic evidence that could possibly implicate Ali or Iran. A fire would not destroy everything that was part of the plan. There needed to be just enough evidence left behind to feed the conspiracies dominating social channels. He'd suit up, take what he needed from the basement, set the fire, and be out of the state before anyone connected the fire to the outbreak, if they ever did. The world gave the Americans too much credit. They had grown stupid and weak. A generation of fast food and instant gratification had left them soulless. He thought of all he had accomplished. He remembered the wailing of the women, the rotting meat permeating his olfactory nerves, his brother hanging by his neck, legs stained with piss and shit. He briefly thought of traveling south to kill the former Secretary of Defense in New Mexico, the man who had prolonged and armed both sides in the Holy Defense, the Iran-Iraq War, the man responsible for the death of his father and two brothers. He pushed that notion aside. Rumsfeld would be dead soon. He was an old man now. Ali wanted him to see his country burning. before he descended into the fires of hell. Ali stifled a cough. Was he coming down with something? There is no way he could have contracted the virus, was there? He'd taken precautions, unlike that idiot Ustinov. All he needed to do was dismantle the computer, start a fire, and drive east for his flight back to Europe to watch America destroy itself on Al Jazeera. Ali grabbed a screwdriver from a drawer in the kitchen and was halfway down the stairs when he heard the knock on the door. Chapter 49. Interstate 70, Denver, Colorado.
"What did you find out, Reese?"
Vic asked over the encrypted connection. The Suburban sped down the deserted highway toward Denver. Ken was behind the wheel and Haley was in the back seat, quiet, and still fuming at Reese's behavior with Sharam.
"This virus is not, I say again, not from Angola. Sharam built a virology lab in that house he bought in Denver. The man I photographed leaving my first target house in Chicago was his contact."
"Do you have a name?"
"No, but we are going to the Denver house now. Is SWAT or HRT on scene?"
"Reese, this is an unprecedented situation. SWAT and HRT have their hands full. The country is descending into chaos. Politicians are at each other's throats. Coordinating with local authorities and even federal offices is bottlenecked. Request for SWAT was approved, but they are not yet on site. There should be a black and white on scene now, but I have not received confirmation."
"Shit. Understood."
"Did he verify the type of virus? Is it airborne?"
"It's something called Marburg Variant U. Haley says it was originally from Africa and weaponized by the Soviet Union in the 70s. They were working on an aerosol delivery system."
The Suburban's brakes locked up and Reese was thrown forward in his restraint.
"What the fuck? What are you doing?"
the commando shouted at their driver.
"Protesters, sir. They've shut down the highway."
"Damn it, keep going. Just keep it slow and try not to kill anyone."
"I'm not trained for this, sir."
"Keep the doors locked and slowly edge through them."
"What's going on, Reese?"
Vic asked.
"Crowd of protesters blocking the highway."
"Jesus Christ."
"Vic, you have got to tell the president this is not a naturally occurring virus. We are going to upend the Denver house and find a connection to the man in Chicago. He's the key."
The Suburban slowly approached the protesters. Their voices became louder. Anti-government signs, chants.
Mr. Donovan?
Ken said nervously from the driver's seat.
"Don't stop, just move slowly."
"Vic," Reese said back into the phone.
"Tell the president not to order the strikes until we can confirm if this thing is airborne. If it's not, he's going to kill 500,000 people for nothing."
"The president is under serious pressure from both sides of the aisle to stop the spread, to do the unthinkable."
"What? I thought the final option was a closely guarded secret."
"It was, but it leaked. It's not out in the public yet, but enough people are talking about it in Congress that it won't be long."
Sir?
Ken said. The Suburban was completely surrounded. Protesters pounded on the hood and windows as the large black vehicle crept forward.
"I don't like this, sir."
"Neither do I. Just keep going."
Antifa signs repurposed from the events of the past year were held aloft by men and women in black hoodies with masks. One man climbed up over the hood and onto the top of the slow-moving vehicle, slamming his fist onto the roof and screaming obscenities.
"Keep it slow," Reese said. "Just don't stop."
"Surprised you don't just plow through them,"
came Haley's voice from the passenger row.
"I don't want to hurt these people. I understand their position. That being said, I will not let them keep us from our mission."
Reese and Haley were still dressed in the CBRN suits they had changed back into as they reversed the sanitization and sterilization process on their way back through the mobile Level 4 biocontainment module. Their masks were off as soon as they were well out of the containment zone and DMZ.
"What's happening, Reese?"
Vic asked, the strain in his voice obvious.
"Still working our way through these protesters."
"Get to that house. Find me something that confirms this is not airborne. Something concrete. If not, I fear the president will have no choice. If destroying these cities saves the country, possibly the world, he's got no choice.
Just hold him off. Do not drop. Give me time. Even at the slow pace, Reese jolted forward in his seat when Ken slammed on the brakes again. Reese looked ahead and saw why they'd stopped. The crowd had parted. Four armed men blocked the path, pointing shotguns and ARs directly at the front window of the Suburban. Chapter 50. Reese didn't hesitate. OODA. Observe, orient, decide, act. Weapons, enemy, threat. Reese picked up his left leg and pushed it over the center console, slamming it onto the gas pedal. At the same time as all 420 horses leapt to life, he grabbed the steering wheel. Their vehicle had become a weapon. Steel shot from the scattergun impacted the passenger side of the windshield, which spiderwebbed across the screen. Two of the ARs barked, one missing completely, the shots going wildly high over the vehicle and protesters. The man with the second AR found his target just before the large vehicle connected with him and sent him careening to the side. The driver's side of the windshield diverted the trajectory of the bullets, but not enough. Ken's body absorbed a round that drove down into his stomach. A second hit his headrest. A third entered his shoulder and fragmented into the top of his heart. A fourth passed through his throat, spraying blood across the steering wheel, dashboard, and the left side of Reese's face. Haley screamed as the large vehicle thumped over the man with the shotgun, dragging him for a few yards down the road before the right rear tire caught his leg and spit him out. "Get down!" Reese yelled at Haley. He kept his foot on the gas, driving from the passenger seat, putting distance between them and the threat as bullets whizzed overhead and along the pavement beside them. Ken's body slumped forward in his seatbelt, body draining of blood, draining of life. Reese elbowed him back in his seat and kept him pinned in place as he put more distance between them and their attackers, the Suburban speeding up past 100 miles per hour. Reese moved his elbow from Ken's chest and attempted to apply pressure to the throat wound with his left palm while keeping the car on the road, his hands slick with blood. He took his eyes from the highway to assess Ken's wounds. Instead of a young, freshly shaven face with an unruly mop of blonde hair, he saw a young bearded SEAL in body armor and helmet behind the wheel of a Hilux truck on a dusty road on the outskirts of a village in Afghanistan. Reese holding the wheel while attempting to stem the flow of blood spurting from his teammate's neck, just before another AK round tore his head off.
"Reese! Reese!"
Haley's screams brought him back to reality, and he swerved to keep the Suburban on the road.
"Stop the car, Reese! Stop the car!"
she shouted. Reese looked in the still-intact rearview mirror and confirmed they were off the X and about 2 miles down the road from the ambush. He pulled to the side of the empty freeway and turned his attention to Ken, holding pressure on his throat and sliding a finger through the blood to plug the hole.
"This thing should have a trauma kit," Reese yelled to Haley. "In the back, find it."
Haley threw open her door and ran to the back of the Suburban.
"It's locked. Hit the unlock button."
"Shit."
Reese moved farther across his seat, pushing a finger from his left hand into the hole in Ken's neck, his right hand slippery with blood, searching desperately for the button on the driver's side door to release the back lift gate.
"Got it."
Reese heard a beep as the rear lift gate arched skyward, Haley reaching underneath to accelerate its power-assisted movement. She appeared at the driver's side door and Reese grabbed the handle to open it.
"I've got him,"
Haley said, tracing Reese's fingers to the hole in Ken's neck and packing it with gauze from the kit. As Reese felt Haley replace his fingers with gauze, he pushed himself back to the passenger seat and exited the vehicle, his eyes scanning in all directions for threats as he rushed to Haley's side and helped ease Ken to the ground. Haley continued to stuff Ken's neck wound with gauze while Reese took a knee and ran his hands over Ken's body, looking for additional injuries, finding the entry wound in his shoulder and immediately applying pressure.
"Another entry wound, left shoulder," he shouted.
"Reese,"
Haley said calmly.
"Do we have more gauze?"
"Reese,"
she said again. This time Reese picked his head up.
"He's gone, Reese."
Reese looked back to the shoulder wound, then to the throat, and then into the eyes. Ken's face was ashen. There was no rise or fall of the chest, no beating of the heart. Rhys looked at his hands, then to Haley. The left side of his face was covered with what was now drying blood. Ken's blood. He saw a young seal lying in the red Afghan dirt. The left side of his head was missing.
"Rhys, he's gone,"
Haley said again, the compassion in her voice directed at the former SEAL commander. Rhys shook the Afghan memory from his mind. Without another word, he stood, hoisting the young CIA analyst to his shoulder and laid him in the back of the Suburban. "Load up. We have work to do." Chapter 51. West Colfax, Denver, Colorado. Rhys pulled the Suburban to the curb a block from the Target house. The street was deserted, though this was not the type of neighborhood whose residents would have second homes in Aspen or Telluride. These families were sequestered to protect themselves and their loved ones from the unseen threat of a virus with an epicenter only miles away.
"Which one is it?"
Haley asked. "That one," Rhys said, pointing. "See the beige Crown Vic?"
"Yeah."
"That's an unmarked police car."
"I don't see the cop,"
Haley observed. "Neither do I. One car in the driveway," Rhys continued, looking at the dark, late-model Jeep Cherokee backed up to the garage. "Can you tell what state those license plates are from?"
"New York, I think,"
Haley said, squinting through her glasses. "That's what it looks like to me, too. Maybe a rental?" Rhys said aloud.
"Could be."
"Haley, I don't know what to say. We would not be here without you." Rhys paused. "I need to tell you something that's highly classified. It's probably going to break into the news cycle soon anyway. I just need you to know why we're doing this."
"To find the source of this virus. I know why we are doing it."
"That's part of it. But I'm talking consequences. Haley, if the President and Congress think that a virus with an 85 to 90% mortality rate is airborne, highly contagious, and confined to two U.S. cities, they, or I should say, the Commander-in-Chief, has an option at his disposal to contain the spread."
"Not a vaccine. We talked about that. There isn't one yet, and you don't miraculously create one by finding a monkey or index case like in the movies."
"No, not a vaccine. A more drastic solution."
"I don't understand. There is likely evidence in this house to prove that the virus is aerosolized, that someone has to physically come into contact with the aerosolized virus. Those infected can only spread it the same way Ebola is spread, through direct blood or bodily fluid contact, not via respiratory pathways. Once we have that evidence, I get it to the CDC, and we let the American people know it's not contagious in the way they've been led to believe. We continue to treat the infected, but without the fear that a cough or sneeze will spread it. If we prove it's a bioweapon and that it was aerosolized in an attack on Aurora and Richardson, we can move forward, rationally."
"We're on the clock, Haley, and so is the President. If we can't prove, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that this is not being spread from person to person, the President is going to incinerate the containment zones to prevent the spread."
"What? Just like I saw in Africa?"
"What choice does he have? It's either two cities or 280 million people in the U.S. alone."
"We wouldn't destroy our own cities, would we?"
Haley said in utter disbelief.
"How do you even do that? Nuke our own country? The radiation would be devastating far beyond the borders of the containment zones."
"Not a nuke. A fuel-air explosive. The largest non-nuclear device in the arsenal."
"How long have you known this?"
"Just before we questioned Shahram." Haley's eyes glistened over, her breathing pronounced, her mind weighing the options and possibilities. "I need to make one more call, and I'm going to show you how to use this thing," Rhys said, holding up the Kryptol mobile phone. "Then I'm going in that house. If anyone other than me comes out, tail them and call Vic. Help vector the cavalry in, but stay back. You've gotten us to this point. No one knows more about what's going on and what's at stake than you do." Haley watched in silence as Rhys showed her how to use the encrypted phone to dial the CIA.
Vic, run this plate. Echo Bravo Foxtrot 8473.
Stand by, Reese,
Vic said. Reese could hear him passing the information to an analyst in the background.
Vic, we lost Ken Daniel. Shot by the protesters. I'm so sorry.
Silence.
Vic? Shit.
Reese, I... Vic paused and took a breath. SWAT is en route to your location. I'd ask you to stay outside and wait, but I know you won't, so I'll refrain from wasting my breath.
What's the status on the final option?
Just came from the director's office. She bought us until the end of this cycle of darkness, then he's launching. Congress was informed via an emergency session. They are all in mandatory lockdown on Capitol Hill, but the word will get out. They are all thinking about protecting their constituents and what happens if 90% of them die. This is going to leak, Reese. When it does, there will be mass chaos and the president will have to speed up the timeline. If those trapped in Aurora and Richardson get wind of this, there will be a mass rush on the containment barriers and the virus will get out.
Reese closed his eyes and whispered a quick prayer.
Reese, are you there?
I'm here.
Reese heard mumbling on the other end of the phone.
Okay, that car is a rental enterprise rented by an Ali Ansari through a corporate account of a company called Biodyne out of Switzerland. Doing a deep dive on Ansari now.
Reese's mind was spinning.
Reese?
I'm here, Vic.
I don't need to tell you what happens if Ali is the connection to this virus. If he has the answers that can save Aurora and Richardson.
I know, Vic. We need him alive.
Do what you can, Reese.
I'll keep the director up to date so she can relay this to the White House.
I'm giving Haley this phone so she can contact you if something happens to me. I'm going in.
Godspeed, Reese.
He hung up and looked at Haley. Her revulsion at his actions with Shahram had been replaced with a newfound respect.
Be careful, Reese. Remember, you are going into a biolab, more accurately, a virology lab, and if what Shahram told us is true, one of the deadliest pathogens in the history of the world was grown and converted into an aerosolized weapon in that house. Wear your gas mask. It might not be enough. We are dealing with too many variables and unknowns to be sure.
If I don't come back,
Reese cleared his throat.
Katie knows how I feel, but, could you,
I'll tell her, Reese.
Reese nodded, press-checked his SIG, and exited into the brisk afternoon air. Chapter 52. Reese held his pistol by his right leg as he approached the target house. To anyone watching from the windows of the surrounding homes, it must have been a peculiar sight, though perhaps less so after the events that had recently engulfed the nation. A man in a tan hazmat suit with a gas mask in his left hand and pistol in his right walking down the street in broad daylight. Reese passed the Crown Vic and glanced inside. Empty. He worked his way up the driveway, clearing the Cherokee as he passed. He moved to the front door and attempted to turn the handle. Locked.
Fuck! This is the last time I go anywhere without my picks.
Reese was tempted to kick in the door, but if he had not yet given up the element of surprise, he wanted to maintain that tactical advantage as long as possible. His mind briefly flashed back to a compound in the Hindu Kush, then a cartel drug house in Tijuana, tomahawk in hand.
Focus, Reese.
He backtracked down the front steps into a side gate to a small backyard overgrown with weeds. He reached over the top and flipped up the latch on the other side. An HVAC unit blew hot air out from a basement. Reese moved to the corner of the house and took it wide, working the angles.
Tactical movement is a problem of angles.
The backyard was empty, but for a rusty swing set and cracked concrete pad with an old Weber charcoal grill. A chain-link fence separated it from its neighbor. A sliding glass door allowed access to the home, and Reese could see that it opened into a kitchen. He crept to the side of the glass. As he'd been taught in sniper school all those years ago, his eyes scanned near to far through the glass. Lying on the floor between the kitchen and the hallway that led to the front door was a body.
Reese pushed on the sliding door. Locked. The smell of smoke reached Reese's nostrils at the same time he saw movement through the glass. The sixth sense worked both ways. A man in a level 4 biocontainment suit and mask stepped over the body and turned toward Reese. Reese's brain registered the gun moving toward him. He ducked to the side of the sliding door as 4 rounds pierced the glass and impacted the stucco wall of the adjacent home. Reese changed levels, taking a knee and at an angle sent 2 9mm projectiles toward the shadow that sprinted across the kitchen entrance. Standing, he made his decision. The man inside was wearing a self-contained suit. Shit! Reese donned his gas mask, grabbed the small Weber grill, and sent it careening through the sliding glass door, already damaged from 6 bullet holes. Reese entered right behind the grill, glass cascading to the floor. He held on to the open door that led to a small hallway. A quick glance told him the dead body was a police officer and that his gun was missing from his holster. Reese looked to his right and noticed smoke coming from under a door. Win the fight, Reese. If this is Ali and you kill him, you have also killed 500,000 of your countrymen. Fuck! You have a terrorist in a barricaded position whom you have to capture alive. You have no body armor, no helmet, no technical or tactical advantages. You are fighting in a CBRN suit and mask with a pistol in a house on fire, possibly contaminated with a deadly pathogen, the fire-destroying evidence you need to save the country. Never pay attention to the odds. Reese turned and worked his way back into the kitchen and to a closed door off the pantry. Slow is smooth, smooth is fast. The smoke is getting thicker, Reese. You can't stay in here forever. You'll stay in here as long as it takes. The door opened into a bedroom. Clear. Where are you, motherfucker? Reese felt the heat building under the floor through his suit and shoes, the inside of his mask fogging up with condensation. Think, Reese. He moved back into a small hallway, weapon up, searching, scanning, attempting to override his instinct to shoot center mass, knowing he had to somehow take his prey alive. Laundry room. Another door. Possibly to the garage. Reese deliberately pushed the door open to find a garage stacked with boxes. He registered they were labeled with the names of companies in the scientific space. Don't rush to your death. Make your enemy rush to his. Reese looked at the wall and saw the button for the garage door. He hit the button and heard the door lurch upward on its tracks. Seeing sunlight leak into the dark garage, Reese moved back into the house toward the flames. Chapter 53. The influx of air from the broken sliding glass door and the open garage door had its intended effect. The fire had heat, it had fuel, and now it had more oxygen. The old, rotting wooden floor beneath his feet began to seep gray smoke, flames visible through the floorboards. Reese positioned himself down the hallway where he had a semi-clear field of view. He would be able to see if Ali made a break for the garage, front door, or backyard. The backyard was a confined space. The front door would take a moment to open. The path to the garage was the most likely avenue of egress. The question was, who could stand the heat the longest? Sweat dripped down Reese's face. He could feel himself beginning to cook, feel the suit beginning to melt. Come on, Ali, come out. Be still, Reese. Patience. You are a sniper. Wait. Movement. There. The man in a full level 4 biocontainment suit rushed for the open garage door. Resisting the urge to shoot, Reese sprinted down the hall. Action is faster than reaction. With the mask blocking much of his peripheral vision and in the heat and smoke of the fire, Reese hit his opponent from the side just as he was about to bolt through the laundry room door to freedom. Reese struck him just above the waist with his shoulder, taking him back into the smoldering hallway. The impact snatched Ali's breath away, his hand instinctually moving the gun toward the man who had taken him to the ground. Reese heard the bullet impact the ceiling and immediately pivoted to control the weapon hand. A sharp pain in his shoulder told Reese that there was another weapon in play. Violently twisting the pistol from the terrorist's grip, Reese smashed it into Ali's mask, the self-contained unit absorbing much of the blow's impact. Instinctually, Reese trapped Ali's other hand, which held a screwdriver. Reese now had a gun in each hand that he couldn't use, weapons that were making it hard to control the screwdriver in Ali's left hand. Even when not trapped in a burning house with noxious gases filling the air, a screwdriver could be just as deadly as a blade. Still entangled on the ground, Reese shifted to control the left hand and felt Ali's right reach up to grab the air filter on his mask in an attempt to rip it from his head. Gas, fire, virus, panic. Reese pulled back and jumped to his feet, pulling his mask from Ali's grasp. He threw Ali's gun down the hall behind him and brought his gun up.
"Stay down, motherfucker, don't move."
Ali looked up at the man pointing the pistol at him. "Shit, he knows I can't shoot him. He's the connection." Ali got to his feet, screwdriver still in hand. Flames leapt from the door at the far end of the hall. Reese threw the SIG down the hallway behind them and charged forward to take the fight to his enemy. Two steps into his sprint, the rotting floor gave way beneath him, and his left leg broke through the floor, pulling him toward the fire below. Chapter 54. Arrested in place, Reese regained his balance in time to parry the attack by his adversary, blocking the screwdriver with his left arm and sending Ali into the hallway wall. Attempting to yank his foot from the hole, seeing flames through the disintegrating floor beneath him, he saw Ali recognize that he was trapped. The terrorist lurched toward the pistols at the end of the hall.
"No fucking way, Ali."
With his foot still trapped in the hole, Reese fell backward and grabbed Ali's foot with his left hand, tripping him to the ground. Reese wrapped the leg and pulled the lighter man back toward him. Understanding the strength of his attacker, Ali redirected his movement, and instead of pulling away, he turned back toward Reese with the screwdriver. The sudden change in direction freed Reese's foot, which he yanked back out of the hole, the leg of his suit melting into his flesh. Both men scrambled to their feet, struggling to breathe in the heat of their suits. Reese positioned between the man and all exits from the burning building. When backed into a corner, animals will either run or fight. Ali had nowhere to run. With astonishing speed, the screwdriver slashed for Reese's neck. Blocking it with both hands, Reese quickly reached over Ali's bicep, grabbing his forearm and putting him in a figure four arm lock, controlling the weapon and torquing his shoulder to the outside of his body. Reese stepped into his attacker, throwing his right foot around the back of his opponent's leg, sweeping him to the ground. The small oxygen bottle strapped to Ali's back sent a debilitating nerve pain through his spine when he hit the floor. Reese followed him down, landing on top of him with a knee on his stomach. Still controlling the arm with the screwdriver, Reese switched knees, redirecting Ali's energy and stabbing the screwdriver into the terrorist's thigh. Even through the suit, Reese could hear Ali scream in agony. Transitioning to his other knee, Reese improved his position and drove a palm strike into the back of the tool, embedding it even deeper into the muscles of Ali's leg. Writhing in pain, Ali reached up and frantically grabbed at Reese's mask. Reese parried the first hand and landed a palm strike to the face, the pressurized suit once again absorbing much of the hit. Thrashing in a primal fight for life, Ali grabbed Reese's mask with two hands. Virus, smoke, death, panic. "Regain control, Reese." Reese trapped Ali's hands to his own mask to prevent him from pulling it off. Vision obscured by his enemy's fingers and palms, Reese's free hand went back to the screwdriver, still embedded in Ali's leg. Pulling the tool from Ali's thigh, Reese surgically indexed Ali's top hand with its side, slowly inserting the flathead between the metacarpal bones of Ali's hand, careful not to punch it through his own mask. Feeling the side of the screwdriver pressing through his gloved hand, Ali let go of Reese's mask and snatched his hand back to cover his face. Too late. Reese pinned Ali's arm under his knee, indexed the back edge of the tool on Ali's forearm, and filleted his arm to his biceps, pressing it deep into his shoulder socket. Jerking the tool up to Ali's elbow, he used his left hand to control the wrist, forcing the man to roll over onto his stomach. With his knee firmly planted on Ali's back, Reese retracted the screwdriver and dug it into Ali's other elbow, using the leverage to pull the arm out and behind the back. "Fuck, I need some handcuffs." Detecting a moment of hesitation, Ali exploded out of the submission with an animalistic scream, knocking Reese off balance and shooting in on him from the floor. Still on his knees, Reese sprawled, snaking his right arm across his opponent's throat, latching onto his left biceps in an anaconda choke. Reese flattened the man out and rolled toward his left side, using the hallway wall to walk his hips into the attacker, tightening the choke. Seconds later, Reese felt Ali's last flutter of resistance as he went limp. Starved for oxygen through a filter not designed for smoke inhalation, Reese peeled himself away from Ali's unconscious body. Feeling lightheaded from the smoke and heat, Reese looked back down the hall toward the body by the front door. Not trusting how long the blood-deprived brain of his opponent would stay shut off from the world, Reese grabbed Ali's right arm, feeling it pull from its socket, and dragged him down the smoke-filled hallway. Reese knelt by the downed police officer and checked for a pulse. Nothing. He then reached around to the back of his belt for his handcuffs. It was only after he cuffed both of the terrorist's hands behind his back that he noticed the bright red arterial blood spraying from Ali's femoral artery. Chapter 55. Not knowing exactly what to do when she saw the house start to go up in flames, Haley had called 911 to report a fire. She breathed an audible sigh when the door flew open and she saw Reese rush outside. He had a man in a biocontainment suit on his shoulders.
"Shit,"
she said, hitting the start button and putting the large vehicle in drive. Reese stopped at the base of the driveway, looked to Haley approaching in the black SUV, and continued across the street to get away from the heat of the growing inferno. He dropped the man unceremoniously to the ground as Haley screeched to a halt, blocking a neighbor's driveway with the Suburban.
"Oh my God, Reese, are you okay?"
she asked, exiting the vehicle and taking in his injuries. Reese ripped the mask from his face and sucked in the cool Colorado air. He put his hands on his knees to steady himself and then straightened back up, looking from Haley to the still unconscious form at his feet.
"I'll live, I think," Reese said, rolling his shoulder from where the screwdriver had impacted and looking down at the burns on his left leg. "Get me out of this thing," he demanded, pawing at the neck seal on his suit.
"Here, let me,"
Haley said, helping him remove what was left of his protective equipment. With the suit off, Reese was able to access the Northman blade in his pocket. He knelt and cut the plastic-attached hood and face shield off the terrorist's biosuit. "Do you have that phone?" Reese asked, holding out his hand.
"Yes, right here,"
Haley said, handing it to him.
"I also called 911 when the house started to go up."
Reese glanced up and down the street. He could hear sirens in the distance. He saw neighbors now looking out at the fire from their windows and at the strangers in the street, still afraid to come outside because of the confusion surrounding the virus. "Good move," Reese said, a plan forming in his mind. "He's got an arterial bleed on his right leg. Apply pressure." Haley took Reese's hazmat suit and placed a portion of it over the terrorist's wound, pushing down with both hands in an attempt to stem the flow of blood.
"He's not going to make it long if we don't stop this," she observed.
"I know."
Reese took multiple photos of the man the Jeep in the driveway suggested was Ali Ansari and sent them to Vic via encrypted message along with the text, "Ali Ansari, confirm."
"Where's your gun?" Haley asked,
melting inside. The sirens were growing louder. "Haley, we need to get out of here and back to the airport. Whatever is in that house is gone. Ali here is our only link to the virus and he's bleeding out."
Haley stared at the man before her, left pant leg shredded with what were obviously serious burns in need of attention, bloody shoulder, drenched in sweat, and possibly the only man who could prevent a disaster unprecedented in American history.
"I'm in, Reese. Let's stop this thing."
"Wait here."
Rhys dashed back across the street to the Crown Victoria, holding up his arm in a vain attempt to block the heat of the burning home. He bent down, pulled a stone from the dirt and weed-infested front lawn that bordered the driveway, and threw it through the driver's side window. He reached in, unlocked the door, and opened it. Quickly searching for the trunk release, he pulled it and ran to the rear of the vehicle. Among a few bottles of water, jumper cables, trauma bag, police windbreaker, and a black plate carrier with body armor was what Rhys was looking for. A 12-gauge Remington 870. He pulled out the dependable old shotgun and pressed the action release. There was not a round in the chamber, so Rhys flipped it over and checked to make sure the tube was loaded. He then grabbed the trauma kit and police windbreaker before running back across the street. "Here, put this on," he said, tossing the windbreaker to Haley, who now had her knee on the wound. Rhys's phone buzzed. "Confirmation. Ali Reza Ansari, Biodyne executive, entered U.S. 1 month ago, Swiss citizen, originally from Iran." Rhys shoved the phone in his pocket, then knelt and put the shotgun on the ground. He unzipped the trauma kit and pulled out a North American Rescue Combat Application tourniquet.
"The wound is too high. That might not do it," Haley said. "We are going to need to clamp it."
An ambulance turned onto the street. Rhys could hear additional sirens in the distance that he assumed were fire trucks. "Haley, have you ever stolen an ambulance?" Chapter 56. Luckily, the ambulance arrived on scene before any other emergency vehicles. Haley had waved it down in her oversized police windbreaker. Rhys showed the driver and paramedic his U.S. Marshal credentials and gave them a half-truth about needing to save the life of his suspect. He doubted the first responders would be understanding or supportive of what Rhys was prepared to do to their patient to get the information he needed. Together, they loaded the man into the back of the ambulance, and as the fire trucks turned onto the street, Rhys was glad he'd grabbed the shotgun. It helps to be armed when stealing a government vehicle. "Haley," Rhys yelled from the back of the ambulance where he sat with Ali Ansari duct-taped to the gurney. "Can you get us to the interstate and back to the airport?"
"I think so," she said,
speeding through the streets with sirens still on. "The police are too busy dealing with an insurrection to look for a stolen ambulance, but you never know."
"Yeah, on their list of priorities, I agree, this is not at the top."
"We need to keep him alive long enough for me to ask him some questions."
"You know I'm a microbiologist, not a trauma surgeon, right?"
"I know. Turn off the sirens and park by the overpass up ahead."